Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Commonwealth Club. I'm just really delighted to have Dr. Amin Azam speak tonight. I had the honor, actually, of teaching a class with Amin for nearly 2 years. It was great fun. I know him well. I know his work well, but I want to do him justice, so I actually do have an official introduction that I'm going to read about him, so you get a little bit of background information. He completed his undergraduate degree at the University of Rochester during medical school at the Medical College of Virginia. He participated in the inaugural year of the National Institutes of Health's Clinical Research Training Program. After completing medical school, he participated in the research track of the General Adult Psychiatry Residency Program at the University of California, San Francisco, Department of Psychiatry. Not done with his education yet, he then completed a 2-year research fellowship in psychiatric genetics at the San Francisco Veterans Administration Medical Center, before discovering that his true passion was medical education. Deciding that 27 years of formal education just wasn't enough, he went back to school for a 2-year master's degree in education at the University of California, Berkeley, focusing on quantitative methods and evaluation. So please welcome for this delightful talk. Okay.
Thank you all very much for coming. It's really a privilege to be here at the Commonwealth Club. I wanted to just to outline for you today what I'm hoping to share with you, and then I look forward to a dialogue at the end, hopefully plenty of time for your questions. I'm going to make an analogy today to a flight, and what I'd like to suggest we do in our flight, I'm going to start by figuring out who you are, and by way of analogy, that's sort of the equivalent to our check-in and boarding process. Then I'd like to describe the 10,000-foot view of becoming a physician. We can think about that as our flight plan for today. We'll then go on to a relevant historical aside, which is your in-flight movie. We'll go on to talk about some visioning from some colleagues of mine at UCSF who have some big national thoughts. That's your view out the window at that 10,000-foot level. And then we're going to zoom in on the 5,000-foot view of medical school, specifically of the programs I'm involved with here in the Bay Area. And then that's your coming in for a landing. So let me start just by checking in with your boarding passes. So I thought it would be useful for me and for all of us to get a sense of who we all are here in the audience. Look, there's a plane flying by even just as we spoke. Convenient timing. So I'd love just a show of hands here to get a sense from you all. How many of you are either physicians or physicians in training? Show of hands. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay. And how many of you are someone who has a relative or close friend that is a physician or a physician in training? Okay. How many of you are other types of health professionals? 1, 2, 3, 4. How many of you are someone who, and you can raise your hand more than once, of course, someone who's involved in health professions education in some other way? 1, 2, 3, 4. Great. And how many of you haven't raised your hands for anything yet? So 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Okay. Okay. Well, welcome. Even though you have nothing to do with medicine or medical education, I'm delighted that those 11 of you are here to hear and learn something new. Okay, great. So now that we have a sense of who you all are, I'm going to come back to this slide several times, but what I'd like to talk about is how one goes from being a college kid to a medical professional. So let's pretend that that little cloud there is college, and a lot of people remember their college years fondly, so it's drawn to be a nice, soft little cloud. And somewhere after college, you go through a 4-year process of medical school. And that's always 4 years here in the U.S. So those lines represent the different years of medical school. Then you get your MD after your name, or the initials. You're allowed to put the initials after your name. But then you have to go on for additional training, which is generally referred to as residency. For most programs, although this is variable from parts of the country and parts of different types of specialties, that is anywhere from 3 to 7 years duration. So those last two dotted lines represent the variation in length of residency. And generally, the first year of residency, the first year of being a doctor, is called internship. Then when you finish residency, you're what I would call a full-fledged doctor, meaning you are then allowed to go off and practice medicine without a formal supervisor above you. So the residency years are usually with supervision. However, some people will go on, some types of doctors will go on to be other types of specialists, or and that period of training is called fellowship. That is anywhere from 1 to 3 years. And that, for example, is the type of physician who wants to be a pediatric cardiologist or a thoracic surgeon, so that they have to have additional subspecialty training. And at that point, after finishing fellowship, that physician is then a full-fledged subspecialist. Okay, so that's a general 10,000-foot view, and I am only going to be speaking today about the first 4 years of this medical training pipeline. So it's important to realize there's a lot more that we could talk about beyond that. But today, just those first 4 years. Okay, so let's zoom in on those 4 years and think about how they're structured. Traditionally, the first 2 years of medical school are called the classroom-based years, and the last 2 years of medical school are called the hospital and clinic-based years. This structural model of medical school education is referred to as the 2+2 model, as in 2 years of classroom, 2 years of clinical. But I want to point out that it hasn't always been this way in medical education in the United States. So you'll notice the plane is leveled off. We're ready for the in-flight movie. Just like an airplane, you've got to start it early to keep the audience engaged, right? So let me move on to a relevant historical aside that is called the Flexner Report. So for those of you that aren't familiar with the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching, it's based here in the Bay Area down in Palo Alto, and it's an independent policy and research center whose mission is to support needed transformations in American education through tighter connections between teaching practice, evidence of students' learning, and the communication and use of this evidence. So the Carnegie Foundation promotes teaching excellence across different areas of education. And in 1908, the Carnegie Foundation commissioned a man named Abraham Flexner to conduct a study of medical education in the United States. Here's Abraham, I think, looking rather dapper in his suit. The goal of their commissioning him was to survey the existing structure of medical schools and, quote, clearly define the relation of professional education in medicine to the general system of education in the United States. Flexner spent a year and a half visiting all 155 U.S. and Canadian medical schools that were in existence in North America at the time, surveying them and looking for evidences of best practice and evidence of weak practice. What I'd like to do is show you, so the Flexner Report is a big, big deal in medical education about 100 years ago now. And what I'd like to do is share with you some of his write-up, his description of some California medical schools at that time. So here's one called the California Medical College, and he describes it as an eclectic institution that he visited in May of 1909. You'll notice there was no clear definition of what entrance requirements were for medical students at the time. There were a whole whopping 9 students there, and they paid about $1,060 each in tuition. And if you read the laboratory facilities, I'm not going to read all of the detail, but a few neglected rooms, the anatomy is a small box of bones and the dried up filthy fragments of a single cadaver. And at the bottom here, his really sort of... really, I would argue, hostile words. This school is a disgrace to the state whose laws permit its existence. Okay, so that's rather harsh words for one of these national report type things. Here's the second one. I live in Oakland, so I thought I'd pull out the Oakland College of Medicine and Surgery. He visited it around the same time. Notice that the entrance requirement for the medical students was to have a high school or equivalent degree. There were 17 students here. No full-time teachers, but 32 teaching staff. These students paid an average of $2,760 tuition. And the laboratory facilities here, some small separate laboratories for a few specific areas, bacteriology, histology, et cetera. And though there are no full-time teachers, there is evidence of active interest in pathology. And interesting, very specifically, postmortems are abundant and intelligent use through a fortunate connection of an instructor in pathology. So thank goodness for that fortunate connection. But in regards to both dispensary and hospital, clinic facilities are decidedly inadequate. So just a couple of examples of the med schools that used to exist here in the Bay Area. In his report, Abraham lauded what he called the Johns Hopkins model. And I actually recently learned that he himself was not a physician, but his brother trained at Johns Hopkins as a physician. So he had visited Johns Hopkins and talked to his brother before he started the national survey. So hence the name of the model. And Johns Hopkins at that time had a model in which students had 2 years, medical students specifically, had 2 years of instruction in the university classroom, followed by 2 years in a hospital or bedside learning. And so this became known as a Johns Hopkins model, or the 2+2 model. And Flexner recommended then, at the end of his report, that a med school should properly be in a university department to provide sufficient resources for instruction in laboratory techniques specifically, that schools should be located in large cities where the problem of procuring clinical material practically solves itself. It's sort of weird to be thought of as patients as procured clinical material, but and that there should be only one med school per city, because at that time in American history, each city really only had one strong university in each city. He went on to say that in the instances where universities were not in large cities, there would be a possibility of what he called a split-half med school, meaning 2 years at the university campus learning classroom-based instruction, followed by 2 years of hospital-based instruction in the nearest large city for the last 2 years of med school. Okay. Since he figured that most med students would be in-state, he figured let's have at least one med school in disparate parts of the country, so that would allow the med schools to teach the students about the diseases of that region of the country. At that time, travel was not nearly as wide as it is now, of course. It's estimated that based on the results, based on his report, somewhere between 7 and 22% of the existing med schools in North America at the time closed or merged because his report was so scathing and clearly exposed the weaknesses of their training years. Put another way, med schools at the time were very proprietary. So if I wanted to open up the Amin Azam School of Medicine here in Oakland, I could just open up a shingle, tell people, come and pay me tuition, and I will teach you how to be a physician. And when when I've decided that my kid's college tuition is paid for, I'll consider you graduated, and you can go on to open your own practice. So very irregular, each of these schools. And so this report really, really revolutionized and changed medical education in the U.S. and Canada at the time. I think it's important to notice, however, that many of the schools that closed were the only schools at the time that were enrolling women or African-American students. So, and something that took us years and years and years to recover from. Just to put that into perspective, I want to show you a map of the actual number, location, and distribution of med schools in 1909 that existed. So you'll notice that Chicago has a whopping 18 medical schools in Chicago. And Flexner recommended that we have a map that looked like this. So I'm going to toggle back and forth between this so you can see how many med schools he recommended shutting down. So, you know, there's a lot of schools on the East Coast here that he just recommended we consolidate, one med school in each major city. Revolutionary in the world of medical education, in the history of medical education. I can't oversell the impact of the Flexner Report. Okay. One more California med school I want to highlight for you, established in 1872. First 2 years of it were at Berkeley. The entrance requirement was strictly enforced. Students had to have 2 years of college work. There were 36 students, 60 teaching staff, laboratory courses at Berkeley. Tuition was a whopping $7,000, quite a bit significantly higher than the other med schools I showed you. And the laboratory facilities are of the highest quality, he said. Sole question to be raised concerns the medical atmosphere, which it's not strongly in evidence, but post-mortem work, there are abundant opportunities for it. And the scientific method is widely available or widely emulated in the institution. Now, how many of you noticed that is the, a little bit more. Clinical instruction is given in San Francisco, in a hospital that has 75 beds. Bedside teaching is carried on. Some additional clinical work is at hospitals maintained by the city and U.S. government. Laboratory and clinical departments are not yet correlated, but the practitioners who are not in touch with the laboratory efforts at Berkeley, so there's some room for growth, but there's efforts made to bridge the gap. And then he said the hospital is not too close to the dispensary, and students, what do we say? Some of them have nothing to do with making up the records, which are separately kept in the several departments. So clearly some room for growth. Now, how many of you recognize this institution as our very own UCSF, the predecessor of UCSF? So an example of the contrast between med schools that closed and one that stayed alive. Okay, so what I'd like to do now, and the reason we spent time on that movie, is to talk about some visioning that is occurring today in modern medical education. So a couple of, to borrow a quote from Al Gore, some inconvenient truths I'd like to highlight about medical education today. Remember that we're still doing this 2+2 model that we started 100 years ago now. But how much more do we know now about the fundamental sciences underlying human biology than we knew 100 years ago? And secondly, how much more complicated is healthcare delivery now than it was 100 years ago? As an aside, I forgot to mention at the beginning of the talk, when I put the title of this together, I had no way of knowing that this would be a week after we had this major healthcare reform. So very convenient timing for me. Lucky, I suppose. But really, it's true. When you think about it, even before the healthcare reform bill was passed, how much more complicated is it now today than it was 100 years ago? But we're still doing this 2+2 model of medical education for the most part in every medical school in the U.S. So that doesn't really sit well with me and with a lot of medical educators that we're still following this model. So it begs the question, is it time for Flexner 2? Is it time for us to reassess the model of medical education and decide whether this is really working 100 years now like it did 100 years ago? Fortunately, the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching actually says, yes, it is time to reassess that. So they once again commissioned a national study of medical education. And it's one of five studies that they conducted of what they call the professions. Those five studies being of nurses, the clergy, doctors, lawyers, and engineers. The medical education study was conducted by a number of colleagues of mine at UCSF, Molly Cook, David Irby, and Bridget O'Brien. And they, over a two-year period, surveyed 14 sites in 2005 and 2006. And they were looking for, so here's what they did, 184 interviews, 100 observations, and 104 focus groups of these 14 different sites of medical education. And they were making recommendations drawn on research in the learning sciences. So Bridget's PhD is in education, for example. And their report is coming out later this summer. There's a preview of the cover, and it's called Educating Physicians, A Call for Reform in Med Schools and Residency. In their report, they've given me some permission to share a preview of their book. They're going to make four broad recommendations for medical education, which I'm going to highlight and go into greater detail in a minute. Basically, you can see them there. So what I'd like to do for those four points is talk about where we were before the Flexner Report, we'll call that pre-Flexner, where we are currently, the post-Flexner era, and what we're going to call for today the neo-Flexner era, or what they would recommend we do moving forward in medical education. When you think about the construct of curricular content, as in what do we actually teach in med school? Historically, you've heard me say quasi-science prior to the Flexner Report. In the current era of medical education, we tend to divide up medical education into the basic science areas, histology, microbiology, physiology, anatomy, etc., and the clinical science areas, as in pediatrics, cardiology, psychiatry, neurology, etc., etc. And my colleagues would argue that we need to broaden that and think about an interdisciplinary approach to curricular content. In terms of the structure of curriculum, historically, before Flexner, it was all front-loading. You never saw a patient, you never touched a patient until you learned everything you needed to in the classroom, and then you could lay hands on patients. Currently, we have a model where we have heavy formal learning or classroom learning in the front years of medical school, but there is some opportunities for direct hands-on patient interactions. But it's still a tiny fraction of the curriculum. In the neo-Flexner area, they argue that we should blend formal and experiential learning. In terms of pedagogy of learning, historically didactic, teacher-driven, I will teach you what you need to know. I know what's best. I'm going to say it, and you're just going to memorize it and regurgitate it. Post-Flexner, it's a combination of teacher-driven and student-learner-driven. And they argue that moving forward, we should actually engage the patient as well in that learning process to see what they actually think we need to learn about. which I think is a really novel and important point. In terms of how physicians are prepared for continuous learning and improvement, in the pre-Flexner era, we all memorized what we needed to learn. In the post-Flexner era, there's been an attempt to routinize and automate what's taught and what's learned, as in, this is the formal way to do a physical exam. This is the formal way to interview a patient. You ask first about the history of present illness, and then you ask about past medications, and et cetera, et cetera. In the neo-Flexner era, they argue that we need our physicians to use their knowledge to improve their own routine practice of clinical care. So it's not just this scripted approach, but rather, based on my patients, what is the way that I should be doing things in my clinic to make it better for my patient population? Where you get knowledge, historically based on tradition, I would teach you to use leeches if you felt that the patient was looking a little anemic. Post-Flexner era is very much driven by science. What is the scientific evidence that supports the approach to clinical care? And in the neo-Flexner era, we perhaps need to be collaboratively developing a user community to identify what the sources of knowledge are. So just to put that into a sort of practical example, there's so much information on Google and Wikipedia and all these other online sources now, and my students sort of go to that all the time before they come to me to ask me questions. Now, if I were a traditionalist, I'd say, can't be trusting anything on the web. It's all hocus pocus. But in reality, there's probably some really good stuff there that students can learn that that maybe I can also learn from, and we need to be able to sift out what's legitimate and what's perhaps not as legitimate as what we want our students to be taking. I mean, it would be weird for you to say, to go to your doctor and say, I have this pain in my back, and they'll say, you know, don't really know about that, but let's look it up on Google together. It just probably wouldn't sit well with you. So we need to be able to collaboratively develop what feels right from what sources. Role models, historically in the pre-Flexner area, they were unqualified faculty. Today, it's academic researchers, and they argue that this should be physician innovators, people who in their private practice are innovating the ways things are done, not just people who are in academic teaching hospitals. Two more high points from their report, the concept of standardization and individualization. So what does it take to practice medicine, actually? Historically, the qualifications for practice were that you finished whatever med school you were in. Nowadays, we say you have to pass knowledge-based exams, these big national licensing exams that I'll point out in a second. New moving forward is this notion of six what are called core competencies of physicians. So medical knowledge is but one of six areas, and I'm going to tell you more about them later. But as an example, one of the six is interpersonal and professional communication. So it's not just about knowing that diabetes is X or Y. It's actually how you ask patients about their blood sugars. That's also a critical competence for physicians to be able to do. We'll come back to that in a little bit. Prior to Flexner, there was no national licensing. In the current era, we have the United States Medical Licensing Exam, which is in three parts. In the neo-Flexner era, we're starting to ask, maybe we should restructure that and have two what are called gateway exams, meaning you take one national licensing exam during med school, and you say, if you pass that exam, you are able to graduate from medical school. And then you take one national licensing exam during your residency, and if you pass that, you are now licensed to practice unsupervised care as opposed to supervised care. Again, maybe if we have some time, we'll come back to that. There's some changes going on with that nationally. In terms of the flexibility of the process, in the pre-Flexner era, as I said, no consistent process. Whatever each med school decided was fine. Currently, rigid standardized. 4 years, 2+2, everywhere. And possibility we should look forward to an individualized process with electives, and learners can then decide what areas of medicine do they personally wish to learn more about. The last thing is this concept of identity formation. So how do medical students go from being a student to somebody who identifies as a physician? In the pre-Flexner era, they really didn't have any responsibility of, as medical students, of what it was like being a physician. In the post-Flexner era, currently, we let med students see patients in the first couple of years, but we're very sensitive about letting them touch patients because they don't know yet. We haven't taught them enough yet. And then later in the med school years, we'll say, all right, well, you can touch patients, but you can't do anything very invasive. And maybe when you're older or further along, we'll let you hold a retractor in the surgery. So you can't use the scalpels because you're not there yet. So there's variable responsibility, but ideally, we want there to be a true progression where as learners are demonstrating competence, we can say, look, even though you're only a first-year med student, you already feel comfortable taking a history, so, and you already look comfortable with listening to a heart, so let's allow you to actually use that scalpel even though you're early in your training. In terms of the values of physicians, in the pre-Flexner era, it's all about watch me, and I will teach you what it means to be a physician. You'll just absorb my model. Currently, we call it a hidden curriculum because there's a lot of good and bad role modeling of what physicians should be doing, and med students absorb both the good and the bad. But the hidden curriculum refers to the bad, and that we don't call it a curriculum, but boy, they learn a lot from all those bad role models in medical school. In the future, maybe we need to be more explicit about the values of physicians. So let's define what it means to put your patient first instead of just assuming you'll observe how I do it. Lastly, this formative process is this notion of how one becomes a professional and behaves like a professional. And like the values, this was not attended to historically. Right now, it's very passive. And what we'd like to do is help our med students to define their own engagement in what the professional goals are. So a perfect example of this is historically, all physicians were mostly men who just, they had wives at home who took care of the life-work balance, and they just dedicated themselves to the careers. And the modern generation of physicians, more of whom are women than men, are defining a more balanced work-life approach to their careers. And that is being that is thankfully acceptable, that physicians should have balanced lives. And so that community is helping us define what the engagement and what is professional and in balancing home work life, for example. Okay, so let's continue with our flight. What I'd like to do now is look closely at some of the innovations that are occurring locally about this 2+2 model. Remember, I've told you historically the first 2 years are called classroom-based years, and I want to offer that at UCSF we don't call them classroom-based years anymore. We actually call them pre-clerkship years, emphasizing that there is not just classroom learning going on in the first 2 years. And in the last 2 years, we don't call it hospital clinical-based years. We call it the clerkship years. Okay, so I'm going to start by telling you a little bit about what's happening at UCSF in the first 2 years. Then I'm going to tell you a little bit about what's happening at the UC Berkeley-UCSF joint medical program, which I'm also involved with. Okay, so at UCSF, we have something called the core medical student competencies. And we believe that for students to become competent physicians, it requires knowledge, skills, and professional habits and commitments to continuously learning and improving. We've incorporated what we call the 6 core competencies that medical students need to have to become competent physicians. And for those of you that are physicians or in medical education, these are parallel to the American Council of Graduate Medical Education core competencies of what graduate medical trainees or what residents should be able to do to be competent physicians. Today's physician does not work in isolation, so we believe that the critical competencies include collaboration and teamwork, as in collaboration with other physicians, what we'll call the interdepartmental thing, collaboration with other health professionals, as in how you work with nurses, collaboration with patients' families, and then collaboration with community resources, as in the patient is working with the local community advocacy organization around diabetes or whatever the issue may be. Okay, so these 6 core competencies are medical knowledge, patient care, interpersonal communication skills, the concept of professionalism, practice-based learning and improvement, which I'll expand on later, and systems-based practice. So let's look at UCSF's curriculum a little bit more closely. The first 2 years of medical school, the pre-clerkship years, are a series of courses that are run in blocks that you can see the names of here, and a course called Foundations of Patient Care that runs in parallel to that. And that course is a course that I'm one of the co-directors for. I'd like to look at that course a little bit more in closer zooming in. It's a longitudinal 18-month course, runs in parallel to the other medical knowledge-focused courses. And the overall course goal is to transform students from a successful student to a successful medical professional. I should say most med schools have a course like this. They sometimes call it Intro to the Patient, Intro to Doctoring. In any case, almost every med school has a course like this. And we believe that learners are not empty vessels to be filled up by us sort of imbibing knowledge, but they should be active participants in their learning who learn best by engaging in actual practice. We also believe that for every learning activity, they have to have a self-awareness of their personal strengths, their personal weaknesses, their attitudes and reactions to experiences, and they should be challenged to learn in new, different ways of thinking. And they should be able to practice this so they can get progressively better. A couple more points. We believe that medical education is a lifelong process in which learners need to maintain a curiosity of the unknown, because after all, med school is a tiny fraction of our professional lives, and we need to be actively learning in those 25 years after we finish our formal training as well. We believe that learning is enhanced by longitudinal approaches that encourage a logical progression of the curriculum, longitudinal continuity with faculty, peers, and patients. And we also believe that learning is enhanced in a relationship-centered learning environment where there's an emphasis on the respectful and collaborative relationships between students and faculty. Patrick, who introduced me, and I worked together as a small group leader for this course. So we got to work with a group of 6 students that we followed for 2 years, or those 18 months, to watch them grow professionally and to meet with us and learn and talk with them about their professional growth. So we use several curricular strategies in our course, a few lectures, a lot of small groups like Patrick and I did together, some preceptorships where the students are shadowing clinicians in their clinic, seeing patients with them, and some skills practice sessions. So, for example, opportunities for students to work with volunteer patient actors who play what are called standardized patients. So that way all the students get the opportunity to interview somebody who's got a pain in the right upper quadrant when it hurts when you push here, as an example. Okay, so if we unpack that a little bit further, our course here has, there's the sort of color coding with those other blocks. If we use a little, some other color coding here, that blue represents lectures in our course, red represents skills practice sessions, and purple represents a specific clinical skill relevant to that block. Our course marches out longitudinally with things like intro to medical interviewing, how you document, how you work in teams, how you work across cultures, how you write up what's called a SOAP note, clinical reasoning, taking a sexual history. You can see that we kind of march in time over some of these different core doctoring concepts. We also give them these small groups along the way so they can practice doing interviews of real or volunteer patients or patient actors, dispersed longitudinally throughout the course. In the brain, mind, behavior block, we have something called psych apprenticeships, so where they have an opportunity to interview patients who have psychiatric or neurologic symptoms. In terms of the physical exam skills portion of our course, we have up front some heavy loading in what we call our physical exam skills boot camp, where we want to make sure they're immersed in how to conduct a physical exam. How do you listen to somebody's heart? How do you palpate their belly? How do you listen and look for skin lesions, et cetera, et cetera? So a sort of front loading of the physical exam skills, followed by some opportunities to practice that later in the academic year, to put it all together with, again, volunteer patients or patient actors. And then the neuro apprenticeships is an opportunity to practice a very specific skill called the neurologic exam. We have some medical knowledge content in our course, a session called Information Retrieval and Management, and this touches on the information explosion of Google and how we help our students sift through all that information to figure out what's relevant. To give them skills to practice that, we give them what are called problem-based learning sessions, and I'm going to explain that in greater detail in a bit. And then to put it all together, we give them those preceptorship shadowing experiences with volunteer patients in the community clinics, so students can see it all, how it all comes together. We also give them practice experiences on campus with faculty members observing them doing these activities. So a complicated course, but one where we think longitudinally about the development of the students. We also assess them. We've got to make sure they're actually learning what we think we're teaching them. So we have some opportunities throughout the year for them to do that. Okay. I want to talk about a few other innovations that UCSF's been doing of late that I think are wonderful and helpful in our development of our students. So there's this new thing we started about a year and a half ago called team learning and communication skills, and those are dispersed across the 2-year curriculum. So those are the slots there. And the concept here is that we don't all learn in isolation and we shouldn't just memorize facts and do it alone, but we need to work in teams. So here are some core opportunities to learn about working in teams. What does it mean to hear from your peers about how well you performed, and really more challenging the things that you're not doing so well that you should really work on. And how does that feel when you hear from peers that you didn't really do a good job interviewing that patient? And then how do you present on teams, and how can we work together as a team moving forward? Another innovation UCSF has is what's called peer-facilitated small groups. Those are in the piloted just this year in the metabolism and nutrition block. And the notion here is everything I've said so far is faculty expert. But our students have a lot of expertise themselves. And why not help and teach and learn from one another as peer? So these are some small groups where there's no faculty member in the room. We're giving them problems. We're saying work through them and use your resources to figure out as peers what you know and what you don't know. And if that's successful, we'll probably expand that in other areas of the curriculum. Okay, there's one more innovation at UCSF that's going to take a little bit of explanation, this concept of a portfolio. And I want to encourage you to think about an artist portfolio. I'm not an artist, but I know artists have their portfolios where they put examples of their best work in it. So when they go to a coffee shop and they say, I'd like you to display my artwork, or maybe even these right here, the sort of you can say, here is my artwork, and this is what I've done. So this concept has been extended into education as a learner's portfolio, defined as a purposeful and longitudinal collection of evidence of learner-selected work that demonstrates their progress. And so it features the criteria for selection on judging the merit and includes evidence of learner reflection. Most broadly, I would encourage you to think about this as an academic Facebook, okay? Because I don't know how many of you use Facebook, maybe not a lot. I don't actually myself, but our young people do all the time use these social networking tools. And so why not take advantage of all the infrastructure that has? So it's an academic Facebook, and students then record evidence of their lifelong learning rather than look at me at this party or look at my friends or who I'm friends with to say, here's how I've grown as a medical professional, okay? And to put that into a sort of a simulation, let's pretend we have a medical student named June who's a first-year student. In medical school, as she goes through med school, she's going to create her portfolio. And there are going to be opportunities to have things to put into that portfolio. So we'll call those artifacts. So maybe that's her score on an exam. Maybe that's her interview of a patient early on in the doctoring course. Maybe that's a chance to hear some feedback from her preceptor about how she did on the physical exam portion, and et cetera, et cetera. So these artifacts become created during med school. And June can decide for herself what to put in the portfolio. She can decide that she doesn't like that red one and she's not going to put it in there. But at whatever time she wants, she can move these artifacts into her portfolio. Okay? Does that make sense? So now let's just pretend that I am her doctoring instructor. At some point, I need to see how she's progressing. So she creates what's called a view of her portfolio for me to observe. And she decides which artifacts to take from her portfolio for me to see. Okay? And then I can look at how she's progressing. Of course, what's interesting is that June is going to go on to be a second-year med student. And in second year, she's going to begin to develop additional artifacts, which she can then again selectively decide to bring forward into my view of her portfolio. And what that does then is it gives us an opportunity to see June's growth over time. Totally different model than what we've been doing in medical education until now. So this is a really innovative area, I think, that has a lot of potential. Okay, so that's UCSF. Now I want to share a little bit about the UC Berkeley Joint Medical Program. It's a 5-year dual degree program. Students spend the first 3 years at Berkeley conducting both a Master's of Science in Health Sciences as well as the first 2 years of medical school. They receive their MD from at UCSF when they finish. There are 16 students per cohort. They do, as I said, the first 2 years at UC Berkeley, but they spread it out over 3 years because they're simultaneously doing master's degrees. And their curriculum is primarily problem-based learning. I told you I was going to cover that. And so here it is. Here's their curricular structure, 3 parallel curricular arms. I'm not going to go into great detail, but what I'd like to do is propose to you that those are not like the courses that we saw earlier at UCSF with it, metabolism and nutrition or brain-mind behavior. They are paper-based cases of patients that students work through in small groups. So if we were to just pretend hypothetically that in Unit 6 each of these blue boxes represents a week of med school, the students may have a case of a patient with breast cancer in the early portion, and they may have a case of a patient with acute heart attack. But those students then will go through the same content that the UCSF students do, but they will learn all that same material in parallel, if you will, rather than in series. That's right. So that those content bins get filled based on the paper-based cases, but not on the sort of lectures that faculties provide. Okay. And if you were to unpack that a little further, the students, the way it's structured, they meet in two groups of eight for 2.5 hours, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. So there's an example of a small group. And when they're working through that paper-based case, it goes page by page, and they're generating all sorts of questions of things they don't know and they don't understand. And they may get through 10 pages in the 2.5 hours. And by the end of that, they've got a whiteboard littered with questions they want to learn more about. And they decide they're going to prioritize the top 2, 3, 4 things to learn about, and they call them learning objects. So they create handouts for each other. Specific students decide, I'm going to teach you, my peers, how to listen to the heart. And they post these handouts for each other in advance of class on Wednesday. They read them in advance, and they come to class prepared to learn from one another. And they start class by teaching each other what they learned. Then they continue with the same case. So on Wednesday, they're now learning what happens to Mrs. Jones, page 8, 9, 10. The same case, the same simulation. But now a whole bunch of new questions, of new things they still don't understand. Same process, create the top 3 or 4 learning objects for that case. And then create handouts, teach each other in advance of class on Friday so that they can begin by deepening each other's understanding. The theory behind this process is that learning is an iterative process. So you start with a problem, you struggle with it, you have questions, you work through those questions, you learn, you generalize to other types of patients, other types of problems, but that generally leads to applying that to other patients, but usually comes back around to new problems, new experiences, new questions. And learning really is this iterative process. So you go progressively deeper and deeper of understanding about your patient's problems. And the model behind PBL is that learners are actively engaged in learning, so they will retain it longer than if I just memorized it for an exam. And they will integrate the fundamental sciences in the way they need to practice medicine as physicians. So that's the theory behind problem-based learning. Put it visually another way, let's just say that the students are working on a case that and this bin here represents the bin of knowledge of renal and urinary systems. So they will come with different cases progressively to different areas of learning about the kidney. So metabolic disorders of the kidney, systemic disorders of the kidney, and these little balls are their understanding that keeps coming back to that bin. Over time, they keep coming back to the anatomy and physiology. So it's not like we just lecture to them and they learned it and forgot it, but they reinforce what they learned and deepen their understanding because they keep coming back to it over and over again because that's what they want to learn about then and what they feel most is a deficit in their learning. So you can see that they keep coming back. So this bin ends up being integrated differently than those content bins I showed you earlier in the other area. Okay. Variation in the use of PBL across med schools. I'll just share that it's widely used. At Berkeley, it's 100% of the curriculum. UCSF, it's less than 5%. And then if you look at it across university medical schools in the U.S. and Canada, it's generally a portion of the curriculum, but not a huge significant amount. At Berkeley, we believe that it's so fundamental to learning that we make it 100% of the curriculum. Okay. All right, so I'd like to just zoom back out for a few minutes. I know I'm running short on time. Everything I've said so far is happening in the first 2 years of med school, but what's happening over here in the last 2 years of med school? So let's look at that briefly. Some stuff that UCSF is doing. Traditionally, there's this thing called rotations. You go through different parts of the hospital at different times and in no particular order. And some students do these other areas, but mostly people do those 7 core rotations that are in the colors. So some of the innovations UCSF is doing is to have a specific sequence of this. So maybe it's important to have medicine before surgery so you understand that. Maybe we should have specific immersion at specific sites. So, in other words, model SFGH says you're going to do OB-GYN neurology and surgery all at San Francisco General Hospital. So you understand the needs of those patients at that hospital. Valor is the same model at the VA hospital, and LIFE stands for the Longitudinal Integrated Fresno Experience. So, again, clustering the students to specific sites. There's also this thing called the LCE, which is students shattering the same physician in 22 visit outpatient clinics throughout the whole year. And this thing called intersessions, which are classroom-based experiences, so you can have all 140 students together in a classroom to talk about the ethical dilemmas of working with patients or how you handle medical mistakes, for example. Okay. One more thing that's exciting is this thing called PISCES. And it's this notion that we get rid of this segregated thing, just like I told you about PBL. So it's all going to happen concurrently, where you're going to work in all of these areas simultaneously over the whole year, and that over time you'll get progressively deeper understanding of how to care for patients with multiple problems. And what's nice about that is it follows patients longitudinally. Patients love it because they're students with them the whole year and in different parts of the hospital. And then students and faculty get to work together longitudinally so you can see the evidence of their growth over time. Same thing as that portfolio I told you earlier. You can see them getting better. Okay. Fourth year, traditionally, it's referred to as medical tourism, meaning I as a med student have no responsibility, and I can just choose to do whatever electives I want. And sort of you have all the all of the knowledge without any of the responsibility. So historically, a lot of physicians say that was the best year of training. I loved it so much. I got to go do an international rotation. I decided to do whatever I wanted. Nobody called me. I didn't have a pager. It was great. But maybe instead of a model like that, what we should start to do is really so one thing we're doing is we have this capstone course called CODA from the musical reference to say, if you didn't learn about how to do CPR by now, before you start as your first year as a doctor, well, you darn well better learn it now. So let's do that. And then maybe we should have our learners define in advance what they want to get out of fourth year. So they develop a longitudinal plan for themselves and maybe increase the number of electives where they actually are really responsible for patient care. Couple more things that are prospective innovations for the fourth year. Maybe we should think about content on advanced clinical reasoning, physicianship, and evidence-based medicine. Maybe we should have a new classroom-based session around managing medical errors. And maybe we should expand that competency framework of those six core competencies into the fourth year of med school as well. Maybe a longitudinal year-long backbone, standardize a way of assessing our learners, and have a quality improvement project where they improve their experiences for students who come behind them. Okay, one little hop up on our, we're coming in for the landing, so one little hop up before we sort of smoothly set down on the tarmac. Remember that I've called this the 2+2 model of a medical education. At UCSF, there's this wonderful innovation that I think is really exciting that says, why do we have to stick to this just because Flexner said this is the way it should be 100 years ago? Why don't we have something we're going to extend the classroom years into the last 2 years and extend the hospital-based years into the first 2 years? So UCSF calls this the 3+1 model. So watch the graph. What we're going to do is going to get rid of the term classroom-based or hospital-based years. And starting at the bottom, right before colleges, we're going to have this progressive increase in clinical experience and responsibilities, a progressive decrease in classroom-based stuff, but they're still mutually together for three continuous years. So that way our learners are truly progressing as physicians. You might ask, what's going to happen in that plus 1 year? And I'll just a little preview to close is something called the Pathway to Discovery program at UCSF. And this is this notion of helping physicians do more than just be physicians. So how can they go beyond the care of individual patients? There are five pathways at UCSF. They're sort of akin to a college minor. In college, you didn't have to do a minor, but if you did, there were requirements you had to fulfill. Okay, so these are the five areas that UCSF has said, if you want to learn more about global health, you're welcome to do so. And so we're going to give you some formal courses in it, maybe in your fourth year of med school. And we're going to make sure that you have an experiential component. So maybe you do an international elective for the global health thing, or in the health professions education pathway, you have to teach to, you know, not just learn, but you have to give a lecture. And then what we call a legacy project, where you leave something behind at UCSF that makes it a better place than when you started. So all five of these pathways have that general format. And what's really fun about pathways, I think, is that remember that I've only been talking about these 4 years, but pathways really gives you an opportunity to build across the full continuum. So residents can be in the pathway and fellows can be in the pathway. So that way you go from being a med student to an international expert in hepatitis because you've been at it the whole time in that sort of that area. Okay. So in closing then, and we'll have some time for questions. I'd just like to thank all my team members. Thank you for flying with us today. I maybe have been your pilot, but there's a lot of other people in the industry. My cabin crew is all of my peers at the UC Berkeley side. My mechanics are all of my peers at the UCSF side. The ground-based crew are all of the wonderful staff on both campuses that have really helped all of us develop these courses. And then I can't go without thanking my co-pilot, my lovely wife, who helps me to be able to do all this. So thank you all, and I look forward to any questions you may have. Please.
How about in integrating some of the alternative medicines, the alternative? Are they going to start doing that?
Yeah, I'm assuming everybody heard the question. So how about integrating some of the alternative practices in medicine? Yes, I didn't cover that at all, but the answer is that, yes, there are some schools that are indeed integrating that. At UCSF, it's not a requirement, but there are some elements of the curriculum where we have opportunities for learners to learn about alternative and complementary areas of medicine. So on the UCSF side, we have a paper-based case, one of those PBL cases of a patient who goes to a botanica, and the students are then challenged with the opportunity of learning what botanicas are. As one example. There are electives in a lot of U.S. medical schools around acupuncture, for example, and opportunities for learners to engage in other areas. And I think the more progressive medical schools will actually take it from being elective to actually be, you need to be exposed to these things because our learners our patients are absolutely going to be engaging in complementary and alternative. I mean, even that term just makes us so central. But our patients are going to be engaged in a variety of healthcare recipients, receiving a variety of healthcare. So we as physicians need to be able to ask them about them and understand what other areas they're involved in. So for sure there are schools that are integrating that to some degree. Let me start over here.
With the passage of the health bill, we're going to have a tremendous need for more healthcare practitioners. It seems to me that you could have people at sort of below the physician's level who would be providing a lot of the care, like with the flu or cold or something like that. How would the program you outlined still be intact, but you wouldn't go with all the extra years beyond that, or would you modify the curriculum on the way?
So there's we've talked only about the U.S.-based model. Certainly, there's some effort to two answers. The first is within the U.S., there's also all the other areas training to be other health professionals. Historically, like UCSF has a nursing school, but the med school and nursing school don't really interact with one another at all. So one of the efforts that's coming down the pike is this interprofessional education where our students are engaged in learning together in the same classroom so that we learn how to work with each other. Certainly there are lots of other medical professionals that are not physicians. So I think those models will continue. And beyond my sort of scope of understanding would be some of the debates around how many med schools should we have versus physician assistant schools, for example, and how many students or graduates should we to have in each of those programs. So I think that should be continued to be discussed because there's a lot of other professionals that can provide high-quality health care that are not physicians. I'll tell you that internationally there are some interesting models where I think is a country in Southeast Asia that I've heard about that in developing medical education, they actually have a model whereby the number of years you're in training determines the type of professional you are. So rather than having separate parallel nursing school, physician assistant school, and medical school, you can say if you want to stay in school for 3 years, you can finish and become a nurse. And if you continue for 2 more years, you can finish and become a physician assistant. And if you continue for 3 more years, then you become a physician, which is a really interesting model to integrate all the healthcare professionals. So that's an interesting approach.
Now, I understand you probably had your speech, pre-programmed, but it's set aside. But since what happened last week with health reform, I understand that there's a need for like 13,000 more physicians. And I understand, I heard that there's like Texas, University of Texas or Texas A&M, they have a 3-year program where for GPs or family physicians, it's like an accelerated program. because of health reform and with gray power, and there's 330 million people in the U.S., and of the 330 mil, 70 are, senior citizen. And what I'm alluding to is the longevity of human beings. So there's an outcry of longevity and with physicians. So what is your take on with what you said? Now, with the Flexner report, would that be accelerated or would it be modified or?
I'm really glad you asked that because it was something I forgot to mention in this slide. I told you about the 3+1 model. So one other element of the plus one is actually shortening medical school. So if medical students can demonstrate their competence in all six areas by the end of 3 years, then maybe they are ready to go on to their internship year without needing to spend a full 4 years in med school. So for sure there are some innovations in that. And I know there's other institutions, as you've alluded to, that do that already. So for sure. The other thing about the aging population is that I do believe that a lot of medical schools are making an effort to integrate more geriatrics training into the requirements for medical school, specifically for that reason. And then there's also pushes in med schools, various med schools, around primary care and encouraging medical students to choose careers in primary care. So there's an example of a program called the PRIME program, which stands for Program in Medical Education, across the University of California med schools. And each med school has a different area of focus for the PRIME program. So UC Davis has a PRIME rural focus, and the idea is to encourage medical students to pursue careers working with the rural underserved patients. And the UCSF UC Berkeley program is PRIME urban underserved. There's a PRIME Latino focus at UC Irvine. So again, to encourage students to pursue careers with certain target patient populations. So that's another example of a way to help meet the needs of Americans in different areas.
We're looking at the fact that there's significant amounts of toxicity in our environment now that's affecting our health, and that historically those toxicities, the information about them was suppressed by the industries that produce them. And I'm wondering if that information is being integrated into those first 4 years or not.
I don't know how much it's integrated, actually. I can't say from my experience in the sort of course that I'm involved with. I know that there are environmental and toxicology elective-type courses and rotations that students can elect to pursue. Some of that, for example, for the subset of learners who may choose to pursue a master's in public health, that may be areas that they wish to pursue, for example. I don't know how much it's being actively integrated into the required experience of medical students today. And by the way, I know we're late, so if people need to leave, please feel to trickle out, but I'm delighted to continue to engage with questions.
I was very encouraged by your emphasis of the fact that the doctors learn from each other in the clinical situation. But it seems to me that there needs to be a continued emphasis on learning, and maybe the patients have something to teach the doctors, too.
I completely agree. This what I've talked about was only the I'm going to see, I'll jump to a slide real quick. But remember that my focus has been nearly exclusively on those first 4 years of the medical training pipeline. I didn't even draw arrows out there beyond sort of training. And but that land is called continuing medical education. It's changing now from continuing medical education to lifelong learning. And to emphasize that point, and to think about how we maintain certification of physicians. And I think the model of learning from our patients is a great one, and we just need to continue to sort of engage that further. Some of the proposal from the second Flexner report is emphasizing that as well, that our patients are going to be part of our teachers in how to be good physicians.
Yes, my question has two parts. The first is in the 4 years of medical school, how important, what percentage overall is the research activity for the students from the first year one to year four, if there are dissertation requirements or specific thesis, or research is only part of the courses, or it's more flexible or more rigorous. And the second part is, do you teach defensive medicine in medical school here, and what, if not, what is your opinion?
Defensive, you said? The first part of the question is about how much is required in terms of thesis or research, that kind of stuff. At Berkeley, all of our students are required to do it, so all 16 elect to do a five-year medical training program because they want to learn that element. At UCSF, it's not required, but again, in those pathways program, there are some students who will elect to pursue a pathway in molecular medicine or a pathway in clinical and translational research. Those learners, that subset of medical students, will presumably have an interest in the research trajectory in their careers, and so they will definitely be learning some of those fundamental science research question and methodologies. And I think that the challenge here, by the way, is, of course, in the Flexner era, all of us needed to learn how to do research, but it's impossible to be all things in all areas now. So it's okay to allow our physicians to subspecialize in career trajectory. So, for example, I'm in health professions education. I do a lot of teaching, but I don't do as much patient care. And so for me, I need to learn how to be a good educator in addition to patient care. But that researcher doesn't maybe necessarily do teaching, so they don't need to learn the stuff that I need to learn. So subspecializing our career trajectories. The question of defensive medicine, I think that there are some areas in the clerkship years here where we have some classroom sessions for the students around what do you do when you make a mistake. And actually what we try to do is role model by having excellent clinicians come and say, here are the mistakes I made, and here's what happened. As a psychiatrist, I have a patient who committed suicide, and so every year we have a suicide symposium for the psychiatry residents, and we talk about what do you do when a patient kills themselves? And so by modeling what happened to me, hopefully we're demonstrating not defensive medicine. But so those are some of the examples of ways where I see that playing out. There's a question over here first.
Thanks. My orientation to individual and public health is one that is kind of multidisciplinary, but I'm wondering how this new Carnegie report, the findings of this Carnegie report, can be shared with other disciplines beyond just the innovations that you shared for medical school training. Like, for example, on one of your slides, there was a very quick, I saw very quickly something called spiritual and cultural humility. I think that's fascinating just to see without even going into it. But in my mind, I'm imagining it's one thing to have an MD with that kind of education, but if the MD has that, but the nurse doesn't, and the health administrator doesn't, and the insurance rep doesn't, and the the health profession or the health education specialist doesn't, then I feel like something in the total system will be lacking. So how can that report kind of go beyond just the strict profession that we know as medicine and maybe influence law, engineering, nurses, or liberal arts, or anything else?
It's a wonderful question. One of the things that was really exciting about the Carnegie Foundation's decision to survey the five professions, wherever that slide is that there is what they refer to as signature pedagogies amongst the different professions. So there's a certain way of learning that the clergy experience that turns out to be something unique to the process of becoming a clergyman or woman that perhaps the other professions can learn from. And similarly, there's a signature pedagogy in clinical medicine of going in the hospital from bed to bed and then as a team of doctors talking about the patients and learning about them. And that maybe is something that can be exported to other professions. And so by doing this all five, it allows the comparison across the five professions that they selected to learn and see if there's exportable signature pedagogies to the other areas. The other thing about the spirituality thing, I mentioned that systems-based practice is one of the six core competencies, and so that one I never defined, but I think it's this notion that we as health professionals work within a system, and so even if I as the physician know about spirituality and think to ask if my nurse and the colleague I'm working with and the chaplain service aren't engaged around the same dialogue, then we're missing out on an opportunity. So helping our physicians to be aware that they don't practice in isolation but need to engage with the other health professionals is a way to try to tackle that. And so there's some effort to try to create interprofessional electives around this area.
My understanding is one of the big differences between the U.S. medical system and many international systems is that we do have so many more specialists. If you look at Western Europe, for example, many more general physicians. Some people have argued that's part of the reason our system is so much more expensive. I'm sure there are many more elements involved. But I'm curious, given that there are such severe shortages in some areas and an overabundance of specialists in other areas, and given that those decisions are often made based on just crippling medical school debt, how much integrated thinking is going on right now toward, you know, guiding students toward areas where there is long-term need and addressing the cost problem, which is a major one for the country?
So there are some new med schools that have been forming of late, and several of them have models where they argue that the emphasis on primary care, as an example, it will be their core defining mission. So they're only going to accept applicants who up front make the commitment to primary care, for example. There have been historically pushes to encourage students to choose primary care, and a lot of times people come in at the beginning of med school and they say, I'm going to be primary care, and then they get seduced by cardiothoracic surgery or something like that. I think the data is finally amassed enough to prove that students are actually choosing specialties based on costs of the medical school debt and sort of potential salary income. And now that that data is amassed from the American Association of Medical Colleges, I think we can begin to look for incentive structures that, I'm just thinking out loud, what if we had students pay less tuition if they went to primary care? Or there's service models where if you have your med school tuition paid for, then you have to give back a year of service and the National Health Service Corps, or working in an underserved area or underserved community. Those models exist in the U.S., but they're tiny fractions of our physician population, and I know that they exist in other countries, so maybe looking to those as examples. And then the healthcare bill, I don't actually know, somewhere buried in those 2,700 pages is probably something around incentivization for the primary care workforce we're going to need coming forward. Again, feel free to continue to leave, but I'm happy to dialogue more. Okay, one more question then.
So, I didn't actually hear you cover this, but what are your feelings on the MSTP program, so the combined MD-PhD program? And that's super vague to make it more specific. How do you think it's been more successful than a solo MD program and a solo PhD program? Or do you think there's some hidden advantage to combining it?
So for those of you that don't know, the MSTP program is the Medical Scientist Training Program, which is a national program sponsored by the National Institutes of Health for students to be accepted simultaneously into pursuing both medical school and a PhD at the same institution. And the way they've generally been structured is students do the first 2 years of med school here, and there's a break in their training, and they do their PhD, and then they continue on for medical school and then the rest of medical careers. I applied for MD-PhD programs, and I didn't get in. And they're very competitive because they're also tuition is reimbursed. So it's a great way to sort of go through med school without med school debt. But you were committing to also pursuing a PhD. I think what's happened, and a lot of my friends from med school were MD-PhD candidates, what has happened with the historic model is that once they get out here and do their residency, they find that they have to choose between doing the research that's required to be immersed in a PhD and really do that cutting-edge science that helps move the science forward, and the clinical care, because both of them are effectively full-time careers, and they have to juggle those two. So I think that the challenge with MSTP programs is that students don't know when they're fresh out of college what they necessarily want to be when they grow up, and they struggle with it for a lot. And so I don't know the answer, but I do think that what we should do is create opportunities probably for people to enter the pipeline of MD-PhD later and exit earlier if they decide it's not for them. So a leaky pipeline may be a better strategy than just one where we commit to only learners who committed to it early on.